whose great-grandfather was among the early settlers in this area. Romy, do you want to tell us where your grandfather came from?
Yes, Grandfather Ames came first, or was a farmer in the town of Hollyville in 1844. He first came to Fort Fairfield that year, and he received a grant of land from the state for 1,000 acres of land up here on the condition that he build a sawmill for the settlers, or that the settlers could use. At that time, there was a grant of 3,000 acres given to someone on Lovely Brook, another grant of 2,000 acres to someone on Fitzherbert Brook, and possibly there were others. This action was taken to encourage the settlement of the area. At that time, it was all wooded, and they needed people up here to start the settlements going.
Tell us your great-grandfather's full name.
My grandfather's name was Joseph Wingate Haynes.
What is the location of this mill?
At that time, the roads in this area were different than they are now. And east of where the mill site was, there was a road running south called the Haynes Road, apparently because this was settled mostly by Haynes's in that area. The road running by the mill itself was called the Mill Road, and it extended from the Haynes Road to the Center Line Road, a distance of about 1.5 miles. Later, this Haynes Road was extended around what is now Kimball Hill to join with Forest Avenue, and later when it did join with Forest Avenue, it became known as Forest Avenue from Fort Fairfield to the Eastern Line. The road also ran from the mill sites on Mill Road near the brook straight north towards the town of Fort Fairfield and joined the Center Line Road at the property of Patrick McShea. In 1853, a plantation meeting was held at the Black Schoolhouse, which is nearby the intersection of these roads, to accept the road from Wingate Haynes Mill to Patrick McShea's. The towns weren't organized at this time, and it was about 5 years later before the town of Fort Fairfield became incorporated. As a matter of fact, it was March the 29th, 1858, when Letter D Plantation incorporated into the town of Fort Fairfield. They held their first town meeting April the 19th in 1858, and one of the items of business was to accept this road. Plymouth Grant later joined the town of Fort Fairfield in 1867, March the 25th. At that time, one of the items of business was to build a covered bridge across the river at a cost of $6,000. So now we go back to the site of the mills of J. Wingate Haynes. About this time, a fellow come along by the name of Caleb Ellis. He married one of J. Wingate Haynes' daughters and built a sawmill 60 rods below J. Wingate Haynes' mill on the Johnson Brook. He worked part of the 1,000 acres that was granted to Mr. Haynes and for about 11 years. Another mile below this sawmill, another sawmill was built by Osco and John Ellis. This kind of points up the fact that much of the industry of the early settlers was sawmills, shingle mills, grist mills, and factories, you might say, to furnish the needs of settlers in the area. Mr. Haynes also bought about 600 acres of land west of his sawmill in the Maple Grove Schoolhouse area of Fort Fairfield, and he built a large house there, and he lived in it for many years. He was quite typical of the early settlers of the area. They had large families, and Mr. Haynes' family was a large one. He had 17 children. One of the needs for having a large house was to have 17 children. After Mr. Haynes moved to his large house, a set of twins was born. And this is kind of interesting because later they settled in the area and built large houses of their own, and quite similar in style and shape. They were about a half mile apart on adjacent tracts of land of the original 1,000 acre grant. Going to talk a little bit about Maple Grove now, a settlement that was coming into being about this time. Got to be quite an important part of Fort Fairfield history, the early history. It was considered to start at the brook that runs into the mill pond of J. Wingate Haynes. It run west from the mill pond, the brook did. The settlement itself started from that brook and extended south up to the eastern line. All of this area was considered the Maple Grove settlement. Now it's divided into Maple Grove and Fairmount areas. Many of the settlers in this area were considered as members of the Maple Grove area, even though they lived south of what is now Maple Grove, quite a few miles.
Well, really what changed, it was when the railroad came through and they had the station at Maple Grove, and then the potato houses were built there, and they called it Maple Grove Siding, and that's what we think of Maple Grove today. But that wasn't part of the original Maple Grove settlement at all, was it?
No. The settlement started about a quarter of a mile south of Maple Grove Station and extended to the eastern line. It's the distance of about 3 miles and a half. Mr. Haynes brought with him from Hollowell, his home, a herd of cattle. And these were the first thoroughbred Durham cattle brought into the state of Maine. An item in the Portland paper a few years ago mentioned the fact that Mr. Haynes was the original importer of this breed of stock into the of Hereford cattle into the state of Maine. He brought the first Hereford bull in here. Many of the offspring of this bull improved the strain of cattle that was brought into the county. One of the interesting things that happened in this area was that a cheese factory was started right here in Maple Grove and run for many years. At one time they were making about 260 pounds of cheese a day. This sounds like quite an operation. I'm sure that the settlers must have really appreciated an opportunity to obtain this type of food. Then we had other developments in the Maple Grove area that were interesting. The first starch factory was started on the Aroostook River in the village, but the second one was built on land owned by J. Wingate Haynes on this brook that we mentioned as a kind of a boundary of Maple Grove. And a cemetery was built there. The starch factory was built by Mr. Bedell. Also, a schoolhouse was built in Maple Grove, and it was across the road from Mr. Haynes' house. I suppose he had nearly children enough to fill it himself.
This is supposedly the first building that was erected in this town for the purpose of the school. There were schools held in the old fort on Fort Hill Street and maybe a vacant cabin, but the first building that was erected for a schoolhouse was supposed to have been built across from J. Wingate Haynes' home. I think I've read that.
This school was built in 1848. And it was soon followed by the black schoolhouse at McIntosh Corner. It was what is known as the red schoolhouse in the Conant neighborhood, and one at Stevensville, one in the village.
And these grew until there were 27 schoolhouses in 1891.
This black schoolhouse that we mentioned at the corner of McIntosh Corner was really the place where the town meeting was held and the town of Fort Fairfield incorporated.
That was where they held the early plantation meetings.
The plantation held a meeting and incorporated into the town, or became the town of Fort Fairfield after an act of legislature. Their first meeting was held in the black schoolhouse.
Now, what else did we find on McIntosh Corner?
In 1856, the first house of worship called the Union House was built. This was built by several denominations, the Methodists, the Baptists, Free Baptists, and the Universalists. They apparently didn't have money or attendance enough to each one have a church of their own, so they joined together and built what they called Union House. Built on McIntosh Corner, and part of this building is still standing there.
What do they use it for now?
Well, when the church was no longer used, after these denominations had churches of their own, the land was given to the town to build a schoolhouse. Church was moved back from the front of the property onto a cellar, now used as a potato house.
But it is the original building.
The original building is there, and it really still looks original. The type of a building is very identifiable.
And this was the first church that was built in the town of Fort Fairfield, I understand.
Yes, there was also a small Catholic chapel on the Caribou Road, built about 1855. In 1858, we come back into the into the Maple Grove area. J. Wingate Haynes himself was a Quaker, and he started the movement to establish a church in Maple Grove. He apparently contacted some of his former neighbors downstate, and four families came here.
Yes, now I understand these. I read an article in an old newspaper that was telling about state land grants, and it said that this grant of 1,000 acres granted to J. Wingate Haynes proved to be very valuable because it was where the early Quakers, I understand they were poor people, and this 1,000-acre grant was where they got their start when they came to this area. Can you tell us something about this?
Yes, one of the first Quakers to come here was a man by the name of William Sampson.
Now, this William Sampson lived on the land that you now own. He settled here and held the first Quaker meetings for about a year. Do you think it was in this house?
This particular house does date back to about that time. Mr. Sampson bought the sawmill from Mr. Haynes, and he bought the shingle mill from Mr. Ellis. And on the same sites, he established a grist mill and a wool carding mill, and he erected another building and put in steam power. Later, I think this road became known as the Steam Mill Road. The grist and carding mill later were moved to the site of the Whitney Mill on Lovely Brook. These people were the first to establish a church for strictly religious purposes in the area, and the first Quaker meetings were held in the home of William Sampson for about a year, and then the families moved here from other areas, and the Friends Church was built, and it still stands in the Maple Grove area. Sarah Partridge was the first Quaker preacher. She lived in a house on the same lot as the William Sampson house. The two houses are still standing, but the Partridge house has been moved from its original location and is now very near the site of the first sawmill Mr. Haynes had. Friends Church was built in 1863 and was used for many years. After the Civil War, many of these people moved away from the neighborhood.
I understand that it was only a short time that they had as a Quaker church, and then the Methodists helped carry on the work, and the Quakers had monthly meetings. Because so many of these families had left after the Civil War, there really weren't enough to carry the church as a Quaker church.
One of the indications of the activities of the people in the Maple Grove area was the number of different types of industry that developed there. The settlement had its own post office, they had a cemetery, cheese factory, starch factory, with two stores, a sawmill, a shingle mill, grist mill, carding mill. There was a Grange Hall established in the 1880s. The school even included a branch of the high school in the area. Church here, Union House, was regarded as being part of Maple Grove at this time.
You just mentioned the Grange. Could you tell us a little about the Grange?
Yes, the Grange played quite an important part in the social life of the community. Most of the families belonged to the Grange. It was organized in January 11, 1883 by Columbus Hayford. It was organized before there was a hall established for it, and the first meetings were held in the attic of the home of Fred Haynes.
That was your grandfather?
He's my grandfather. The first Pomona Grange was held in the barn of Charles Hoyt. This was later the Lynn Seeley barn. Lynn had a nice set of buildings there, a big barn, and was well kept. A Pomona Grange consists of a meeting of several subordinate granges, and of course there were many more people attending Pomona Grange than would attend the regular Grange meeting, so it required much more room to hold a meeting.
Now, was this the first Grange in Fort Fairfield, do you think?
I'm not sure if it was the first one, but it was. There were three Granges in Fort Fairfield, and I suspect that they probably were all established about the same time. Which one was really the older, I don't know. Records would show it, but I don't have them. In 1887, this Grange organization built a large hall combination deal here on the corner of the Mill Road and the Haynes Road, later known as the Forest Avenue Road. And the downstairs part of the Grange Hall at that time was rented to the town of Fort Fairfield as a schoolhouse. The Grange used the upstairs part for their operation, and the school for some years was downstairs. It's kind of interesting, when we renovated the hall about 4 or 5 years ago, we tore off part of the sheathing on the wall, and there were a number of names of people on the old blackboard written in chalk, and apparently by the teacher at that time. And the names were of people well recognized in the affairs of town Fort Fairfield for many years afterward.
Now, did the Grange serve any other purpose other than being a social time?
Yes, they did. In 1890 or thereabouts, this county was again seeking to organize its own railroad. The county petitioned the Maine legislature to pass an enabling act authorizing Aroostook County to issue county bonds not exceeding 5% of the county valuation for building a railroad. Now, the National Grange, the Pioneer Farmers Fraternity, became the foremost instrument for railroad seeking, a quest rarely within the province of any farmers group. In 1890, this circular letter went out to innumerable Grange chapters throughout the Northeast. I quote, "Worthy brother, a movement is being made in Aroostook to secure the construction of a short line of railroad to this county. Believing that God helps those who help themselves, Aroostook County Pomona Grange has appointed a committee to prepare and circulate petitions in aid of the project. The Maine State Grange has cordially endorsed the movement." The movement continued, and the legislature authorized the county to subscribe $828,000 toward preferred stock for building a railroad. The B&A Railroad reached Fort Fairfield November 19, 1894. The last rail went into place at 2:35 in the afternoon. The last spike was driven at 2:52, and the track-laying engine steamed up in front of the depot at 3:08. There were several hundred people there waving flags. The band came upon the platform before the arrival of the steam engine. When it moved slowly into place, the band struck up played for several minutes, I presume. As soon as the band finished, the engine cleared its throat and gave three loud cheers. A barrel of cider had been brought out, tapped, and was distributed liberally. Later, a crew of 60 was treated to supper down street at Martin's Restaurant. This was an item clipped from a former paper in the town of Fort Fairfield called The Beacon.
Your grandfather was born and lived in Maple Grove, and your father grew up here. Can you remember anything your father might have told about the railroads being built?
My father was about 18 years old at the time the railroad came into Fort Fairfield. It was built through Maple Grove during the winter of 1893. And of course it attracted quite a great deal of attention. Boys being boys hung around to see what the construction crews were doing. This particular construction crew in Maple Grove was a group of Italian laborers, railroad men, and they, of course, had their own cook tents and slept in tents. These tents, by the way, were quite winterized as we know them. They were double canvassed and banked up around the side so that they were warm. They were really quite comfortable. The food that the Italians, of course, ate was foreign to Aroostook County. I remember my father saying it was the first time he'd ever heard tell of macaroni. The Italians also, being Italians, consumed quite a considerable amount of wine, and this, of course, was something foreign to the people of Maple Grove, anyway. Now that the railroad had come into Aroostook County, we find the county changing very fast after this because of the crop of potatoes that could be grown here. We have a record of J. Wingate Haynes raising a crop of potatoes that averaged him 139 barrels the acre in 1852. You can see that the farmers in Aroostook County didn't have any trouble making up their mind that potatoes would be a major crop. So from here on, the economy of Aroostook County is pretty much a potato economy. After the railroads came, we saw construction of large storage houses on the track. We saw the innovation of machinery into potato growing. We saw fertilizers coming in, something unheard of before. And when these fertilizers came in, the yields jumped considerably. Also, the cost of raising potatoes went up some too, but about this time, these farmers could grow an acre of potatoes for $50 to $75, and with a yield of in the neighborhood of 100 barrels and a return of a dollar to a dollar and a half or even $2 a barrel, they were making money, more money than they'd ever been able to make before. The economy changed in that the inhabitants here commenced to work for money instead of just producing goods for barter. Wasn't a great deal of money in Aroostook County before the 1890s, and there wasn't a great deal of need of it, because if you wanted some shingles, you traded some lumber for it, or some oats, or some hay, or even worked for the fellow for a while to pay off the cost of your shingles or whatever you wanted to buy. It was more of a barter deal. But after the potato deal started here, then it became a money proposition, and the nature of the whole county changed.
Well, about what size would an operation be, say, at the time the railroad was built?
Well, at the time the railroad was built, of course, the farmers were still raising their own products pretty much, but when potatoes came into the picture and they could see a chance of making some money on potatoes alone, well, then their agriculture changed. machinery came in that did away with a lot of hand labor, and fertilizers came in to increase yield. They still had the same method of cultivation and one thing or another. We used horses, and about this time a pair of horses were rated according pretty much to the acres of potatoes that a team would handle and take care of during the summer. It run about 20 acres per pair of horses. If a fellow had two pair of horses, why, he'd probably raise 30, 40 acres of potatoes. Then, of course, storage entered into the deal, too, and the amount of land that the farmer had. And even in this day and age, rotation was an important part of raising potatoes. No farmer raised potatoes more than twice on the same piece of land until he rotated it with oats or hay for a couple of years. And of course they were always looking for opportunities to increase the size of their operation a little bit. My father farming along about 1915 to 20 was still clearing land on his property to expand his operation. I remember of them having huge piles of stumps and logs and bushes and piles. They'd work at them in the fall and in the, during the winter when the snow wasn't too deep. And then in the spring, after these